Welcome to season one of Inspiration Loves Company. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Debbie Epstein Henry, a lawyer turned entrepreneur, public speaker, and author. The essence of this podcast is about doing better and being better at life, work, and everything in between. Thank you to the global law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, LLP, for sponsoring today's episode of Inspiration Loves Company. We're so happy you've joined our conversation. Our guest today is Jill Schlesinger. Jill is the Emmy-nominated and Gracie Award-winning business analyst for CBS News, where she appears on CBS radio and television stations nationwide. She is a weekly guest on NPR's Here and Now and writes the nationally syndicated column, Jill on Money. Jill's first book, The Dumb Things Smart People Do with Their Money, was published in 2019. She is the host of the Jill on Money podcast and nationally syndicated radio show. The topic we'll explore today with Jill is safe and sound, building financial stability and wealth.
Don't make a trading decision for 24 hours that deviates from your plan. Just wait. Wait till the market is closed and then rethink it. Don't pull that trigger. And often a weekend can be really helpful.
It's like sending an email that you really want to send and just imposing a 24-hour rule. It's very similar.
Yes. And FYI, don't send that email. I've sent that email, and that's not a good thing.
That was me with Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, when we sat down together on March 4th, 2020 in New York City to discuss Jill's book, The Dumb Things Smart People Do With Their Money. Shout out to Lauren Resnick for putting Jill and I together. Even though we were only 2 years apart in high school, it's funny how that two grade differential meant so much back then. So great to chat with you again, Jill. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me. I'm very much looking forward to this, without the distraction of worrying about spreading virus in a room filled with 400 people.
Exactly. So last time we saw each other, it was about a week and a half before the full lockdown of COVID began. And we were in this very awkward sort of elbow bumping moment in a New York City conference room. And the market was volatile and there was a lot of uncertainty in the room. What I want to do today is revisit some excerpts of our prior conversation and ask you what's changed since we spoke last and focus on your best financial recommendations to navigate these very tumultuous times.
Okay. But first I want to ask you, can you figure out, now we're talking with audio, but I have a video picture up. Can you actually identify the picture? That's the question.
Oh, let me take a close look.
Take a look at that.
Beautiful.
Just see, it's a little bit of a hat tip to my CBS people. That is the Ed Sullivan Theater, where CBS News had to move exactly a week after we had seen each other and making all sorts of strange arrangements to try to figure out how to navigate these times. You know what the good news is? Unlike figuring out where to physically put people, luckily for me, covering the economy and personal finance and businesses, so often the advice I give is completely boring and consistent. And so when I listened to that clip, I started laughing and I said to myself, you see, it still holds. It holds no matter what. And, if you think about that month of March, so there we were. We were talking to one another on March 4th.
Right.
3 weeks later, the stock market, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ, all cratered. We were in a full-blown bear market. Right. We saw, in fact, a third of the value of stocks just chopped within 6 weeks. Mm. And we bottomed out on March 23rd. And I got so many calls, questions, panic-stricken people contacting me. And I realized, here we go. And in my world, it's sort of the most amazing thing that the advice you give really does work, but it becomes much more important when the world's blowing up. It feels like the smartest, wisest conversations you can have. And really, it's the same crap I talk about all the time. It's just that when the market's rising, no one cares.
I guess that begs a question, just your background, how you got into it. Was it that charge or that recognition that, sometimes this is going to be just pinnacle advice that I can provide? What inspired you to get into this field initially?
I have no way to tell you that there was a forethought to the way my career has moved. It has been zigzag. Recently, I've been trying to describe it as climbing a mountain. And I don't know if you've ever done a rock wall or climbed a mountain yourself.
I have, actually. Yes.
So, you know, you sort of belt up. And I was lucky. I was able to belt up because I had a family that had some money. And so I could take different risks in my career that many other people would never be able to take. So right. I'm going to point that out of the gate. I graduated from college. I did not have any school loans. During college, I had done a couple of internships, one specifically with an NBC-owned television station in Providence, Rhode Island. And I loved it. It was so much fun. And I really got the bug of broadcasting. I thought it was fantastic. Summer after my junior year, I split my summer between working in communications and also working on Wall Street because my dad was a trader on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. So I did both of those jobs for the summer. And I came at the end of the summer and I realized, well, you cannot make any money in television. It is really a hard slog. And if you want to become something, you're going to have to go to a remote market where it's really tough. And it seemed like a lot of hard work. And this is, you know, the summer of 1986. I was in the middle of a roaring bull market. It was fun. And I met all these great people. And so I ended up going through the Wall Street route, although not the traditional Wall Street route that most people go through, which is I didn't go through a formal training program. I was a trader on the floor of the Commodities Exchange in New York, and there were 800 members and there were 8 women. And at the time, I was the youngest member ever on the floor because I was all of 21 years old and I traded options or derivatives on gold, silver, and copper futures. And I did that for 3, 4, maybe 5 years. I realized that that's a job which is a really fun job to have had, and it wasn't a job that I wanted to have. And I got really scared, and I had to tell my father that I wasn't going to follow his footsteps. I wasn't going to join his firm. Instead, I was going to move back to Providence, Rhode Island for love. And that love turned into the shortest marriage in the history of time, probably.
Right. A
year, a month, and a day. Maybe not the shortest, but pretty close. And I stayed in Providence, Rhode Island, had to figure out what I wanted to do. And I bounced around and I ended up joining a small financial advisory firm. And to actually start to gain some traction and get clients, we ultimately started to do a call-in radio show. And that really kind of got me going on this path of, wow, it's amazing what the media can do. It's just the reach. And I used both radio and television as a means to get clients. And over the course of, say, a decade, I started appearing on the actual NBC station where I had been an intern, and I was sort of their financial expert. And I did a lot of radio work. And there were two people who were instrumental in my career. One was the program director at the radio station, a guy named Bill Hess, who I love to this day. And the other was a young news director at the NBC O&O named Betty Jo Cugini, both of whom took me under their wings and said, we know you're not in this business for real, but we want to make you better at it.
So generous.
Yeah. And so that's really was the beginning. And I built my company up. I had a partner. We sold it. I moved back to New York and ultimately had to figure out what I was going to do. But in the meantime, during the financial crisis, I had started doing a lot more national news. I bounced around some cables. Someone from CBS saw me. And lo and behold, at the beginning of 2009, I was asked to come into CBS, and I thought they were just going to sort of pay me by the appearance or by the hit, and they offered me a job. And I said, well, I really don't want a job. I ran a company. I'm exhausted. And 3 weeks later, I signed a contract. So since April of 2009, I've been with CBS. I started on the interactive side. I'm now in the news division, and I have the best job in the world. It's the easiest, best job in the world.
Oh, don't say the easiest part. You don't want to give that up, but that's...
No, it's easy for me. Right. You know, like, I mean, if you had to run an organization and had 40, 50, 60 people, depending on your decisions, and been responsible for people's investments totaling $600 million, and those are all the things that weigh on you every night, the idea of having to talk with a camera in your face to millions of people and have someone else do your hair and makeup doesn't seem exactly that hard.
I get that. What's interesting as you recount the different steps you've taken in your career is a lot of people from afar would just think, oh, you've had this linear path and it's been very intuitive. And then when you parse it out, you realize there are different fits and starts where you're identifying essentially what's appropriate, what's fitting for you right now. But the other part of your career that I find to be really interesting is you've made a very deliberate choice to bring your personal life into your professional identity. Can you share a little bit about why and how you made that decision and what it's meant for you and perhaps your colleagues?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I want to say that just in terms of like the career trajectory, and when I was using the mountain analogy previously, I'm not sure I actually finished the thought. And that is that sometimes you have to go sideways to go up.
Right.
And I didn't actually articulate that for a long time. But there are many times in my life where, again, I was blessed enough to be able to take a sideways or even drop down. I think that it's important that if you actually have the opportunity and you have the ability, take a move to the side to try to pursue an opportunity to work with someone who's fantastic, to really find a mentor who's going to bring you along that is so valuable. So I think that what you're talking about is, shh, don't tell anyone, but I'm gay. And I didn't really feel like I had a choice in that. Well, you are familiar with the town where I grew up. You know, my mother was like sitting Shiva for months after I came out in my 20s.
Right. I was actually at the Shiva. I brought the matzah. I don't know if you remember. Yes.
I wasn't there because I had died, remember? You know, it was a very public coming out in the, you know, I would say early 90s. And that was not a time when people were coming out. So in a weird way, it's like turned out to be like one of the greatest things in the world. Mm. And I feel like that was a really huge period for me. And it was a period of growth, not just about sexuality, but just how do you deal with screwing up? You know, you do something dumb and you got to own it. And it was really, really hard. And I went through a lot of, anxiety and hurt and guilt and all of the things that you can imagine are associated with, you know, cheating on a spouse, specifically with a person of your same sex at a time when nobody was really doing that, and having to own it and say, like, you know what? I screwed that up. I didn't grow up in a particularly strict household. I had a pretty loosey-goosey parents, and it was such a shock for them, and more to the point to my mother more than my father. But it was a hard time. And thank God for my sister. I have one sister. I adore her. She was there for me. Her husband was there for me. And they kind of scraped me up off the floor and help me move on. So to fast forward from that, when I was a financial advisor and owner of a company in Providence, Rhode Island, Providence is sort of socially liberal, but the state itself tends to be somewhat more conservative. And so I was sort of kind of out, but not really. And then I really just, you know, had a ridiculous experience at work where my business partner said, you cannot work with people who are openly anti-gay. And so what I carried forth was just sort of being out and proud and not really worrying about it. When I got to CBS in 2009, I didn't really think twice about it. And I was shocked to learn when they were doing their It Gets Better videos that nobody would volunteer to be part of it who was actually in front of the camera. So we had some producers who would do it, but the people who were gay who were on camera weren't necessarily out, or they were not willing to expose themselves in that way. And I was able to raise my hand and say, I'll do it. And so, you know, from the moment I entered the organization, I have been, you know, this is like a loving family, truly. It's really the most remarkable group of people that I've been lucky to work with, all of them. And a lot of my friends now who are, you know, women who are in very powerful positions, the president, the executive vice president, people who are running bureaus, people who are friends of mine, it's just fantastic to see that the organization has moved along. For Pride Month, I was able to host three of our young correspondents. I moderated a panel with them. So we had three correspondents and one transgender woman who's a makeup artist. And I got the most adoring notes from a zillion different people in the organization. So we've made some progress. And so,
exciting.
Yeah, so that's it. I'm proud, baby.
Good for you, and inspiring other people, and particularly younger people who feel they don't have their footing yet. It can be huge, just like the mentors you referenced who you had in your career. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about really the impact of COVID-19. And when we spoke last, we were already beginning to explore the influence of COVID-19 on the market. So let's listen to a clip on that, and then I'll come back to a question.
In light of what's gone on with coronavirus and how volatile the markets have been, what is your advice for people at this moment?
Number one, remember why you're investing. You're probably a long-term investor. Number two, you're probably also a diversified investor. Not all of your money is in the stock market, I hope.
So given what we know now since March, would your advice about the market still be about long-term investing and diversification? Would you add anything else to this advice?
Yes, I would tell you all to load up the truck and buy as much as you could on March 23rd. No, I'm just kidding. In hindsight, yeah, it's great advice. And not just because it comes from me, because it is tried and true that being a long-term investor means you have to actually absorb the hits. I think what's really hard is to imagine this. Let's say that you had called me up and you said, it's Debbie, it's February 25th, and I have a really just a bad feeling. You know, I got bad juju vibes. I'm going to cash. And I try to convince you not to do it. And then you do it. And it looks like a month later, you look at yourself and say, I am a genius. Right. Look what happened. The whole market fell apart. And then we wait to see what happens next. And I got to tell you, the people who were really smart, in my experience, they didn't get back into the market. So the market went back up and retraced all the losses and then went higher. And so the hard part of trying to time the market is that you don't make one decision correctly and win. You've got to make two great decisions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes you can do it by accident. This happened to people I know. I had done a speaking engagement at Salesforce, and I had done that speaking engagement a while back, and someone reached out to me and said, I have a slug of Salesforce stock. I've been shut out of the real estate market. Salesforce keeps going up. What do you think? And I just said, you know what? I just sell that sucker, pay your tax, and just like move on. And, you know, I got a note from her later that was just like, oh, my God, it was crazy luck that you gave us that advice. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's luck sometimes. But sticking with that game plan usually will see you through really bad times and really good ones. The market will tell you over the long term what is right and what is wrong. In any short period of time, there will be dislocations. There will be probably big spikes for no reason. It may be that this podcast will air and the market's down by a third. I don't know. Right. I don't know where it's going, and nobody does. But what we do know is over the long term, when companies do make money, then the market starts to rise. And right now we have a very narrow market where some of the big companies are dominating. But the reality is that this is a terrible time for this country and for the world.
Exactly.
A health pandemic has become a financial pandemic. There is nothing that we can do to really change the course of how this is going to work out in the market and in the economy as individuals. And, you know, it's funny, I moved my podcast to a daily podcast in the middle of March. I used to go twice a week. Now I'm daily. At the end of every podcast, what I say is, wash your hands, maintain your social distancing, and wear your masks. That's what you can do to help the economy right now. Those are the three things. I think that sometimes in the business of managing money, there can be a belief that there is some man or woman behind the curtain who is the all-knowing Oz, who really can give you better advice than you can read in a book called The Dumb Things Smart People Do With Their Money. There may be some really terrific traders that I have seen in my life. But I still come back to the idea that day in, day out, for probably 99% of us, buying a bunch of low-cost index funds, keeping our costs down, and having a diversified portfolio is going to get you where you want to go. Now, I am not suggesting that everybody should do it him or herself. That's not the advice I'm giving you. I'm just saying that managing money is a commodity, and the price of that is about zero right now. It's basically like a quarter of a percent a year. Why do you hire a big-time financial advisor, a CFP, a CPA? It's not to beat the market. It's because you want to get customized financial advice that's going to make you and your family reach your goals. And I think that that's really the issue here. I sometimes hate talking about markets. I had this terrible thing where this young guy asked me to be on his podcast. My college friend was on his podcast and she's like, oh, go be, she's like the head strategist for a big bank. And he says, well, what you're saying is that like you're one of your best friends from college basically is in a baloney business. And I said, yeah. And I tell her that all the time. I mean, I'm glad she makes a great living, but it's just baloney. Right. Nobody's beating the market, you know, year in, year out, or very few are. And really, to what end? What kind of risk are you taking to get there? How much are you paying to get that beat? And, you know, I just feel like we make these things a lot more complicated than they need be. Most of us just want to live our lives and hit our goals.
And what about in this market with so many people who've lost their jobs or they're fearful that their jobs are in jeopardy? Are there any other things that they should be thinking about to increase their financial security?
You know, I always go back to these very three core concepts that have framed my whole life of giving financial advice. I call it the big three. And the big three means that you are very comfortable with 6 to 12 months of your living expenses in a safe, boring cash equivalent account, that you have reduced your consumer and student loan debt as much as possible, hopefully to zero, and that you're maximizing your retirement plan contributions. If you're doing that, you're on the right track. Now, if you're a person who is worried about losing her job, what I will say is stockpile cash, because it's going to be a long time before you get another job, depending on the industry you're in.
Right.
Competition's fierce.
Right.
And so for people who are really worried about their livelihoods, go back to the basics. Really concentrate on those core aspects of your life. And you know what else is I found funny? I was just writing this because I was writing my column for Tribune this morning. And I thought to myself, all those people who used to say to me, I can't save, I can't save, I can't save. Well, you know what? People are saving right now.
Yes.
People who are lucky enough to be in white collar positions or even who have had a reduction in hours, you're not spending on clothes, you're not spending on commuting, you're not spending on going out to dinner, you're not spending on travel. And lo and behold, the savings rate peaked at about 33% in the spring. It's not going to stay there. And maybe it's a 20 and maybe it's going to go to 10. 10%
right.
Savings rate is something I had not seen in my lifetime.
So interesting. Yeah.
So, you know, people are learning that, hey, you know what? I can save some money and saving is good. You're very happy when you have that emergency reserve.
Let's take a short break to hear about our sponsor for today's episode. Here at Inspiration Loves Company, we're all about inspiration, engagement, and impact. For over a decade, I've been so proud to partner again and again with my friends at Kirkland & Ellis, a global law firm that's all about those very things: inspiration, engagement, and impact. Kirkland serves a broad range of clients around the world, providing them with the highest quality legal advice, tailored service, and innovative solutions. But what I admire most about Kirkland is its commitment to making a real difference in people's lives. These attorneys have a genuine passion for providing pro bono legal help to those who need it most. Kirkland dedicates substantial energy, talent, and resources to pro bono initiatives across many significant areas: immigration, civil rights, LGBTQ+ advocacy, veterans benefits, and more. Kirkland's pro bono work is incredibly impactful, and the stories of the people helped through this work are truly inspiring. Check out kirkland.com/pro bono achievements to learn more about Kirkland's commitment to pro bono work and some of their latest projects.
So I wondered, what keeps you up at night about the market, if anything?
And
nothing.
Nothing ever
keeps you're gonna say
nothing
that.
Keeps me up. I'll tell you what, I am a 55-year-old woman, so I'm kept up by many things. The market is not, you know, I'm kept up about worrying about my 81-year-old mother. I'm kept up worrying about the health of my 96-year-old mother-in-law. Mm. I worry about, did I actually commit to do this podcast with Debbie? When is that happening? You know,
definitely talk in the middle of the night. That would be very productive.
I mean, all of these things that I am kept up in the middle of the night by two little terriers who seem to push me around. They're only 12 and a half pounds, but I never worry about the market.
And
I always say that. Let me amend that. I worried in 2008 and I was a money manager then. And my girlfriend was working at a big investment bank. And we worried then because it felt like the financial system was cracking. I then called five people that I knew who said these trading desks are silent and the world is coming to an end. And it was scary. And I was scared then. That I was scared about. I wasn't scared about like, oh, my business is going to go to zero. I was just scared for the world. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Right, right. Does anything about the market right now, just the tenor of things, make you particularly hopeful?
Oh, I hate to pin my hopes on the stupid stock market. Here's what I worry about. I worry about dumb people trading on the Robinhood app and gamifying investments. It feels very 1999-ish. So I worry about that. What gives me hope is that essentially, when you go through a crisis, people do actually come out of it and are more financially responsible. So that it's like, as I started this interview, let's circle back. The same old advice that I give all the time, people are paying attention to now. I wrote an article for Tribune about the beauty of cash and cash equivalents. I've never gotten so many emails about an article about the most boring topic in the universe. And yet it's that people were finally saying, oh my God, now I get it. Now I get that an emergency reserve fund stays in cash. It's not just the home equity line of credit on my home. It's not the extra, you know, stock that I have in my investment account. So I think that what gives me hope is we will come out of this. That I know the economy did stop dead at the end of March and in April because we needed to. And if we need to do that again, we'll get through it. And if the market craps out again, we'll get through it. And, you know, all I want is for people to be much nicer to each other and to wear their masks and to wash their hands and to maintain their physical distancing. That's it. And then, you know, honestly, do something nice for somebody.
Exactly.
Just do it. It makes you feel so much better about yourself.
Exactly. So much of your message is about resilience and about staying level-headed, staying focused, sticking with your plan, as you like to say. Is there anything else you want to end with, Jill?
There is a time to make sure that you beef up your financial life, that you really act responsibly. It's usually not in the middle of a crisis. And if people are wondering, you know, when is this going to end? I don't know when it's going to end, but I know it is going to end. Keep your eye on the ball. You know, I'm an aging athlete. So I played soccer and lacrosse in college and soccer and basketball in high school. And, you know, the aforementioned Lauren Resnick, who brought us together, her father was my coach for my whole life, essentially.
Legendary coach.
And Mr. Resnick was always a real fan of just going back to the fundamentals. So you know what? You're going to shoot 100 foul shots today because that's how you're going to learn how to do it. And if you go back to the fundamentals in your financial life, chances are you're going to stay out of trouble. And if you're running into a hard time, raise your hand and ask for help. Just don't try to go this alone. It's very emotional. Money is emotional. Ask for help. I can give you help. Just send me an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. So if you need help, you can ask me for help.
So great, Jill. I want to thank you for this amazing conversation, but how fitting that you ended on that point about being an athlete. I remember watching you on the soccer field and you've been such a powerful leader in every venue you've been in and really generous to me. So I want to encourage our listeners who have not been following you yet to start now. Go to your website, jillonmoney.com. Listen to your podcast, Jill on Money. Definitely get your book, The Dumb Things Smart People Do with Their Money. I found it a really effective way to distill concepts that a lot of people feel overwhelmed by, and it simplified how to do this management of money effectively. So I also want to thank our incredible podcast team, creative director and copywriter Susie Rubin, executive assistant and events coordinator Renee Green, and our podcast producers, Cortland Brennan and Sam Barber.
Also, thanks again to the global law firm of Kirkland & Ellis LLP for sponsoring today's episode of Inspiration Loves Company. If you are enjoying our new podcast, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, rate and review us, and tell your family, friends, and colleagues. We hope you join us next time.